And welcome to another edition of Odyssey Radio Show. We talk about ancient mysteries and metaphysical topics and unfiltered news of the day. Our topic today is the ancient astronaut theory. And in a nutshell, to describe it briefly, it's that an ancient group of beings created all of these incredible, fascinating monuments all around the world, such as the pyramids. So we have an expert on the ancient astronaut theory today. His name is Lloyd Pye. He will be appearing on the National Geographic cable channel on November 27th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to discuss this theory. Welcome to the show, Lloyd.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Okay, I have a bunch of questions, so we'll just jump right in there. We're going to take a little journey around the globe together here.
All right.
Let's start with Easter Island. It's such a fascinating topic. It's a very isolated location. Why don't you lay out the geography and describe whether you feel a group of tribal villagers created these incredible statues and monuments, or did an ancient race create them?
Well, Easter Island is a special case relative to the monolithic structures, the megalithic structures around the world, because it looks as if it's possible, it's humanly possible for people to have done that, even though highly unlikely. One can make the argument that because of the basaltic rock that was used, that it was possible for humans to do that at the time. They had the trees they would need to have constructed the levers and things that would have been used to move it, to do the rollers and everything, but they cut them down. They did so many, they denuded the geography of the island, which is, as you said, very isolated. So in that particular instance, while it doesn't seem likely, it's harder to argue that humans could absolutely not have done that.
Okay, now where is the gravel pit on that island? Is that at the top of the mountain, or would they have had to take the gravel pit and, you know, roll the statues up the hill?
Well, actually, there's some terrain where they would be going down a hill and other terrain where they would be going uphill. If you know, it's a mountain basically sticking up out of the water, a mountaintop sticking up out of the water. The thing is anyone who's tried to move heavy rocks, and you see this more in Peru, in the megalithic structures of Peru, than you do on Easter Island, again, because the grades are not as severe as they are in Peru. But any time you're moving up a degree of incline to try to pull, it becomes that much harder. The real problem, actually, is moving downhill, because when people have tried to move heavy stones up inclines and down inclines to see how it would have been for them in the old days, what they find is the stone will almost invariably get away from them going downhill, but they can manage it going uphill.
I see. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but 200 of the statues were never completed on Easter Island, so we do know they abandoned the project abruptly, correct?
Right. And it also tells us that the project was going on at a massive level, at a massive scale, and that, in fact, is one of the arguments against humans having done it. But when you go through the back and forth of those who argue that humans could and those who argue that humans couldn't, it still comes out that it's within human capacity to do that, whereas the pyramids, that's not within human capacity, and others are not. But the ones on Easter Island could have been done, and so they stand off in a separate category.
I see. Now, some people believe that Easter Island is the tail end or the last remnant of this giant continent that used to be called Lemuria. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there is certainly little doubt that the Earth looked substantially different in the deep past, and that because of plate tectonics and movement of the land masses over the surface of the Earth, there's no doubt that the Earth was all one mass of land at one time. Now, were human-type beings on the Earth at that time? No, we were not, because our DNA makes it clear that we've only been around as we are for a couple of 100,000 years. This period that we're talking about would have to be beyond that, probably, well beyond that. So any beings that were here on the Earth, and this is not to say that there weren't, but any beings here on the Earth at those times, say between the time of the dinosaurs, which is 65 million years ago, and but 200,000 years ago, which is the time of us, anybody within that huge window that could have been living here, no problem at all, and could have had huge, massive civilizations here that don't show any signs or show very few signs today except for the megalithic structures. So those things could have been here any period of time, although one would argue that if it was, you know, beyond, say, 2 or 3 or 5 million years, that just natural weathering effects would show up pretty dramatically.
Absolutely.
So you have to think that the megalithic structures that we have were within a superior civilization that was here almost within the human time frame of 200,000 years ago, somewhere within there.
I see. Okay, let's move over to Egypt. And I want everyone to go to your website. It's LloydPye.com. It's LloydPye.com. And there's a picture of an Egyptian obelisk. Why don't you explain what an obelisk is, what it represents, because it's kind of a strange-looking monument, and we have them today, even in Washington and Paris,
right,
and explain this obelisk that was never completed.
Well, the obelisk, it's called the unfinished obelisk. That's what it's called. It's near Aswan. And the Egyptians had, now the Egyptian stonework, because of the size of it and because of the problems of moving it, clearly couldn't have been done by humans, even though, of course, classic Egyptologists swear up and down that it had to be, but that, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Right.
It didn't happen. And this obelisk shows clearer than anything why humans couldn't have done it, because it is just another in a series of them that the Egyptians supposedly built, but somebody built. And you see that this one, in the process of being cut and shaped out of the rock bed where it was being, you know, removed from, they broke it. And if you look at the tip of it, you can see the effects of what looks like some kind of a giant machine that was just gouging out chunks of stone off the tip of it, and that machine in the gouging process broke it, you know, created a long crack in it. They just unbuckled the machine and said, oh, well, we broke this one, and they moved on. And they left it. The argument that people make is that somehow using stone tools on pink granite, which is some of the hardest stone there is,
sure,
in a very narrow, confined area that wraps around that stone, they were cutting it out. Even if you make that concession, you've still got the problem of it's down in a 15-foot hole, and somebody's got to get down there and cut it loose from its base and then lift it out of that hole.
Can you imagine?
When we don't have cranes that would do that.
Now, it also would have had to been moved a great distance, right? It wouldn't have just
exactly
stood up in a gravel.
It stood up, right. It'd have to be moved to where you want to stand it up and then stand it up. And supposedly this would be done without the use of any kind of anti-gravity devices, which is ridiculous because, as you see on my website, you've got a 1,000-ton crane, which is the biggest one we have, and it wouldn't have lifted this one, which is over 1,000 tons. And to see what we would have to go through to lift 1,000 tons, and much less move it just to get it up, is absurd. It just simply didn't happen in the deep past, and those who contend that it did are just ridiculous. They're just being ridiculous.
So that's 200,000 pounds at least. I mean, we can't even fathom that number. Now, what do you think the obelisk represented? Was it the legend of Osiris, or was it a rocket ship of the gods they were trying to emulate? What was it?
That's as good a guess as anyone. To try to get in the heads of people back that far, assuming as I do that it wasn't Egyptians, it was somebody else, whether they were leaving a message for future generations or what, I just have no idea, but I would venture to say that probably when the Egyptians, as we know the Egyptians, got there and found all these things, they carved their things on, you know, their messages on them. So to know the real true message, but if you look at the pyramid and inside the pyramid, it was absolutely bare. No carving, no nothing.
No hieroglyphics.
So you have to assume that whatever the civilization was that actually did them didn't leave anything in terms of writing behind, and so the Egyptians just overlaid their own culture and their own history over it. But I'm convinced and confident that those objects, the obelisks, the pyramids, and the other large objects that are megalithic in size, remember the Egyptians built things that were not megalithic, but the ones that were megalithic were not created by the Egyptians.
That makes sense to me. Okay, let's move over to Costa Rica, to a kind of obscure topic. The Costa Rican spheres, these large granite stone balls that are found all around the country. Can you talk about those?
Well, what makes those so amazing is, number one, their size and their weight, that, you know, their heft, and not just the round balls, but the Olmec statues as well, the Olmec heads, which don't look anything like anybody there and are themselves very large, very megalithic in size. But what makes the balls interesting is the symmetry, their symmetry. They are clearly carved. You don't get that kind of symmetry in any way in nature. But what they were laid down to be, we'll never know, because the people who found them early on, if they were in, particularly the oil companies, they would just move them. It's not impossible that they were laying down those balls to stand for some kind of pattern in the heavens. There's an argument that the pyramids are laid out according to star patterns in the heavens. So it could be that those balls were meant to represent, you know, some kind of heavenly scenario that we were, you know, those who found it were supposed to look up and make a connection. But we'll never know, because the records of where all the stones were is so incomplete now and so destroyed because of the oil companies, we'll just never know. But I think it's a good idea, because you have the Nazca Plains down in Peru that show views that clearly from way up in the sky. They're meant to be viewed from way up in the sky. You have the Candelabra of the Andes, which is pretty much the same thing. So it seems as if it's reasonable to assume there was some degree of communication from the past to the future, and these balls, I think, I can't think of any other reason for them being where they are, because they're just kind of scattered around almost willy-nilly. But if you were to see it from on high, you might see, originally in the way they were, you might have well seen a pattern that would have made sense.
I see. Now, what were they made out of? What sort of composite? And where was the gravel pit? And were they rolled a great distance, or were they made in Costa Rica?
Yeah, they were, as I understand it, they're limestone, and the areas that they, you know, there's limestone around there. Whenever you find these megalithic things, they are generally created near the proximity of something that gives the raw material at hand. There is movement, clearly. They do have to move them considerable distances, but we're not talking miles and miles and miles. Where we do talk real distance is, for example, Stonehenge.
Sure.
Where those stones come from, like 100, and I think the Presley Hills are like 120 miles away or something in that range. It's a pretty long haul from where the stones originate in Stonehenge.
Especially without transportation and cars and trucks.
Exactly. That just, you know, it just doesn't make sense for ancients to have been able to do that. And one of the great puzzles that they work on is trying to figure out exotic ways that the people who created Stonehenge might have created it. But the people who created Stonehenge, for whatever reason, if you've ever been there, there's a knoll to a hill. There's a kind of a knoll. They didn't put the stone circle up right on the crest. They put it shanked off to the side a little bit, which meant that in order to get the lintels at the top perfectly flat, which is what they did, they had to put those stones in place almost with micrometers to get the short side to be just short enough and the long side to be just long enough so that the top came out perfectly flat. Why would they go to the extra trouble to do that? Why would they not just crown the peak so that every stone had to be about the same height to make the top lintels flat?
Right.
That's one of the great mysteries of Stonehenge.
Absolutely. I want to remind everybody, you're listening to the Odyssey Radio Show. My guest is an expert on the ancient astronaut theory. His name is Lloyd Pye. He will be appearing on the National Geographic Cable Channel on November 27th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And his website is really great. It's very interactive. It's lloydpye.com, LLOYDPYE.com. Okay, let's jump back in. You touched on the Olmec heads. Now, my understanding is that these weigh 50 to 60 tons,
right.
And that they appear to be African-American or Caucasian. They don't really look like the Indians of that era. Is that correct?
Right. They don't look like the locals at all. They do have Negroid features, but that doesn't even mean that they were that race. They could be something entirely different that really has not been seen before. Everybody looks at, you know, the expanded lips and the kind of pug nose, and they think, oh well, it's, you know, it was modeled after Negroid types. But there are a lot of Negroid types that don't have those characteristics. So I think it's possible that they could have been another group entirely, an off-planet group, just leaving behind emblems of themselves. You know, because they all seem to have different looks, different characteristics, different, like people do. They have,
sure.
Each has a different look. There isn't a model there, but they're just repeating over and over. So, same thing with the balls. Even though they are balls, they're different sizes and again, positioned in different places. So when you take the balls into account, the circular balls and the heads, the positioning of them, that's the real puzzle. Why were they where they were? Because it just seems sort of random. It doesn't seem to have an on-the-ground pattern. Again, just like Nazca, if you're there on walking around the plains of Nazca and you come across any of the lines that create the giant figures from above, you don't even realize you're walking around in the lines. You don't know you're in the figure. It's so big, when you're down there, you're an ant crawling across it. But when you go up above, you can look down and see, oh yeah, it looks like a spider, oh yeah, it looks like a monkey. But when you're down there, you don't have any sense of that at all. So I believe probably that originally, before they got moved around, those stone balls and those heads might have been in a pattern that would have made sense if we could have seen the pattern from above where maybe the message was meant to be received from.
Okay, so since you've touched on Nazca, there's not just symbols of animals and whales and fish. There's also like these giant runways or these long, long roads. What do you make of those?
Well, that's the great mystery down there is what is that? Because those things stretch for miles and miles, arrow straight across this desert plateau, which, by the way, itself seems to have been scraped flat. I mean, you just don't get that much flat land out of the blue like that. It looks like it got leveled. I know how that sounds, but it's remarkable. Vast swatches of it. Now, over time, rain has come through, gullies have cut through, and it's not like a giant pool table anymore, but at one time it might well have been. But the thing is, if they did, this is the mystery, if they did flatten it, where did the stones come from? Because the floor of it is covered with these dark stones, just millions of them. And what they do to make the figures and make the lines, make the runways, quote, runways, is they lift off the stones from that part of the floor, which is light underneath. The stones themselves are dark, but underneath is a kind of a sand that's light. So when you take the stones off and move them to the side, then you have the lines that you see. So the question is, if they flattened it, how'd they get it covered uniformly with those stones and then be able to lift the stones up and make the figures? It's a very, very, very puzzling area down there.
Absolutely. Another area down there is called Saskatchewan. I believe it's near Tiwanaka.
Saskatchewan, yeah.
And
apparently
the stones are cut out into puzzle shapes, right?
Well, no. In Saskatchewan, it's in Cusco. It's above the city of Cusco, Peru. And Saskatchewan is just simply, it's like terraced walls, really. Just terraced walls that zigzag along. There's three of them. It doesn't really make much sense. It's not like a fort. It's not like an embankment where they're trying to protect themselves from something. It's a symbol of something. It isn't to fight or defend or any of that.
Okay.
It's just these giant zigzaggy walls, but the stones themselves, like as with the stones in Egypt and the pyramids, except there, everything's put together with right angles on the outer surfaces of the pyramids because you have to have great precision with with those. With these, and in most of South America, there's a different kind of precision. They're very precise. The stones fit together like glass. I mean, it's just amazing, the same thin lines of demarcation between the stones, but they bevel in to the seams. The seams bevel in. You have the smooth outer surface, and then they bevel in. Well, if you can find places like in Machu Picchu, for example, and at Sacsayhuaman, where earthquakes have caused a little bit of shifting. It's amazing, for as many earthquakes as these areas have, you don't have more shifting, a lot more, but these things were so well put together that they didn't really move much when earthquakes occur. But there's a little slippage, and what you can do is put your hands between the cracks where you find stones that have been moved apart from their original positions, and they are as smooth on the inside where they touched together, they're as smooth as a baby's bottom. But when you go out on the surface where they've been weathered, they're like worse than sandpaper. They're very, very grippy, and they can, if you got knocked into one, you'd come away with a huge brush burn. But on the inside where the stones touched, they're like glass.
So it appears some sort of advanced technology was used.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's just no question. And if you'd like to, you know, study, if you have an engineering sort of bent of mind, there are books written about the engineering of the pyramids and some of these other stones, but particularly the focus is on the pyramids. And it's easy enough to read the traces left behind by the machining tools in Egypt that engineers look at and say, oh, yeah, well, you can see that this was machined. It clearly, a well-advanced technology was at work to put these things together, including almost certainly anti-gravity devices that would allow these stones to be lifted and moved and put so precisely into place.
Absolutely. So I'd like the audience to go see all the pictures over at LloydPye.com, LloydPye.com. And now we're going to move on over to Cambodia. Now, the Temple of Angkor Wat is the largest religious structure in the world, and there's 72 of these complexes. And they were built a bit later, I believe, by humans, around 800 to 1200 A.D. But the architects, I believe, were the gods or an advanced race. What do you think?
Well, these are, like with Easter Island, these are stones the size of which, and in fact, like many of the temples in Egypt, let's just, you know, call it like it is, those are stones that are the size that humans could manage. But, again, the design, and especially if you study the work of Graham Hancock, who's done a lot of analysis on this, you see that the design, again, seems to be predicated from looking above down, and it's creating some sort of symbology on the ground that has some effect up into the sky. But what we don't, you know, we can't really say, although we can see what the pattern of is the temples, and they've tried to make connections to the stars, and they haven't been able to do it as yet. But anytime you have something spread out on that massive a scale and yet that geometric, I think you have to think that it's being created by somebody who's trying to impart some kind of knowledge that has to be acquired from in the air looking down, and it symbolizes something that will be clear if you know what you're looking at, and obviously we don't. You know, Tiwanaku in Mexico, Teotihuacan in Mexico City has the same situation where it looks like if you want to interpret it as such, you can find temples that represent the sun, the moon, the planets moving right on out in the proper order. And so there, too, you have symbology on the ground that looks like it's meant to be viewed and interpreted from above.
That's definitely, Graham Hancock goes into that theory, and he talks about 72 degrees being very important also as part of this. For instance, there's 72 complexes at Angkor Wat, and 72 degrees, I believe, from the pyramids of Egypt. Have you looked into this?
No, I haven't. I think the pyramids actually are on 60 degrees latitude, not 72. But there are those, I think Richard Hoagland does work along this line too, saying that there are planetary vortexes or planetary forces that emerge on all in all of the planets and globes out in space. It's where the spot on Jupiter is, and there's some kind of latitude. I think that might be 74, though, instead of 72. I'm just spitballing here.
Right.
I'm trying to do it from memory off the top of my head. But there seem to be, if you invert two triangles inside a globe, a triangle up, triangle down, where the points of the triangle touch out on the surface of the globe, those are where the energy points, the energy bands, seem to be most intense. I understand that much.
I see. So let's move over to Japan and talk about the recent discovery in the 1980s of underwater ruins in the island of Yonaguni.
Well, the Yonaguni ruins are really interesting because you have a lot of people that go there, including Hancock, that feel that they're absolutely man-made, no question about it. But then you have people like Robert Schock, who is a credited geologist, who is the one who basically has made the argument that the Sphinx is 10 to 15,000 years old instead of what Egyptologists say due to the weathering on the side. So you have to respect Schock's opinion about things. And he feels like that the Yonaguni ruins, at a minimum, are simply the remnants of natural effects, and while they look very well put together, they're not. I don't know what to believe with that, because it really looks man-made to me.
Absolutely.
You know,
there's who's funding him? Where does he get his grants?
Schock? Well, Schock is well thought of, and I know him. I respect Robert Schock a lot, and but his opinion is that there is enough natural formations that break off that way in the area to lead him to believe that it was. What he will concede is that the stone has been worked as it sat. It got worked in later times, which indicates, as we all assume, that the sea level as we have it in the world today was about 300 feet lower in times past before the, quote, Great Flood. Now,
Right. If
you go with that as an acceptable theory, that at one time, you know, not necessarily the biblical account, but the actual physical account of the Earth having ice caps, huge ice caps in the last ice age, and as it was ending, there was a massive, massive drop-off of ice off of the Antarctic continent that fell when blocks of an ice cube goes in a glass, okay, you got a glass of water, you drop the ice cube in, and the ice cube is going to take up the space immediately that it's going to take. So the water level rises with the ice cubes, but when the ice cubes melt, the final water level doesn't change because the ice just turns into more water. So it happens instantly. Well, if all those icebergs dropped off of Antarctica for whatever reason, instantly the waters of the seas rose to accommodate the volume displaced by those icebergs, which would then melt out and become water. That would be the source of the legends of the Great Flood, and that would account, I think, for the 300-foot rise almost overnight that would have wiped all those cultures that were living on the edges of the water, wiped them out.
Now, that would make sense. Now, let me ask you, we only have 5 or 10 minutes left, so let's get right into the heart of this. A lot of Egyptian artwork depicts half-human, half-animal hybrid type of beings. What do you make of this? Do you think this was strictly mythology, or were there some sort of hybrids before the flood or after the flood?
I think at some point in the past with this group of ancient super beings that were here that I think created us, physically created
right. Humans,
and I think they also created all of what we consider domesticated plants and animals. I think this planet was shaped to suit them, to be more like their home planet, and they needed things to live and eat, and they, meaning the domesticated plants and animals, and they needed slaves and servants to do their work, so they created us. And I buy into that, which is basically the theory of Zechariah Sitchin and the 12th planet. I don't see a better one out there.
Sure.
To explain it. So in that process, there probably was a lot of experimentation, a lot of mistakes. You know, genetics is prone to mistakes because what you're working with is so small So mistakes happen, and I'm sure mistakes happened back then. Mistakes happen today. One of the great fears we have is our geneticists creating some thing, some bug that's going to kill us all. It could happen. So that's how I would explain the chimeras that were created and were depicted in not just Egyptian, but in other cultures as well.
Absolutely. And do you believe they were mostly wiped out during the flood and then they kind of started fresh after that?
I think that's a good likelihood that a lot of it was wiped out during the flood, because most, even today, most cultures live on the coastlines because it's, you know, it's food is a plenty, you know, there's plenty of food and you need water. And anyway, so I think that a lot of them, not all of them obviously, but a lot of them did get wiped out along the edges. And I think one of the most productive things we could do is invest in a bunch of those little small submarines and, you know, small 2- and 3-person submarines.
Sure.
To go out and just cruise at about 300 feet of depth around all the coastlines of the world, and I bet you a lot more Yanagunis would pop up.
Absolutely. Now, here's the big $64,000 question. We know from the artwork in the ancient texts that these super beings, these advanced races, used to interact with humans. They used to be part of society. Why did they withdraw? Why did they disappear from...
Well, according to Sitchin in his book, The War of Gods and Men, and according to David Hatcher Childress and his wonderful research into the evidence for nuclear type wars in the past, they began to war with themselves. A lot of our ugliest traits seem to come to us directly from them. And so they were at war with themselves. They had a massive slaughter of each other and of the humans alive at the time, too, due to this war. And so they, because they were so decimated, the survivors apparently left, and that's, we haven't, you know, it isn't that we haven't seen them since, but they left in numbers, and we only, they turned the store over to us, and now if they interact with us at all, they do it on a very piecemeal basis.
Well, I kind of go into David Icke's theory that they're still talking with the secret societies, the Masons and the Rosicrucians and these world governments at the top level, and kind of passing down orders. What do you think of that wild theory?
It could be. I know David, and I have a lot of respect for the work that he does. Some of what he says to me is a little bit off the deep end, but
sure,
that it certainly can't be ruled out. There's obviously higher control of things than we certainly are aware of, but that doesn't mean, just like as with the Easter Island stones, it doesn't mean that it's not, you know, humans doing it, but it could be that there are human uber humans in charge and we wouldn't know, and I don't think there's an answer yet for that, and I don't know how to go about getting one.
Right. Now, one last topic, and then we got to wind it up. Quetzalcoatl was this powerful, benevolent god in Mexico and South America,
mm-hmm.
and he was depicted sometimes as a reptilian serpent and other times as an old man with a beard. What do you make of these two different descriptions?
Well, it's a good point, and there's a great dichotomy there. But if you go down in Peru, it's the same thing. There was something consistent about those old legends with the white men with the beards.
Sure.
Relative, and I would think that applies more to the Anunnaki. But there's also the reptilian, the snake symbologies everywhere. And that, I don't know, that might move over toward the genetics part of things, because you can take a coiled serpent, you know, the caduceus and the snakes twined up around to represent DNA. So it might have been some kind of a bleed off of that symbology that obviously the ancients would have had. I don't know. I lean more toward the white men with the beard, because that is how the Anunnaki are described, and that is how we, you know, look and are, and I think we look a lot like them. I think they did, in fact, make us to look in their image after their likeness.
Right, and we have the two fighting, warring brothers in Mexico, Tezcatlipoca and Quetzalcoatl.
Right.
Could these be the same two brothers, Enki and Enlil, that were fighting at the Garden of Eden in Samaria?
I think it's very, very likely. You have the same group of uber gods in most of these cultures, and you have the same two leaders, the same two with opposite approaches to things, with you know, who are at each other's throats, so to speak, and it starts with the writings of the Sumerians, and it does spread out everywhere, so it's very likely that superculture takes their history from the same source.
And last question, the Mayans had a calendar of about 26,000 years, and so did the Sumerians. How could that be? Two different cultures, same calendar.
Well, because it was given to them. The Sumerians don't make any bones about it. They say everything we have, everything we know was given to us by the gods. So clearly they were, you know, who could know 25,000 year time frame? And so the Maya, who we are not as clear in their writings because there's just not that many of them, we only have the Maya Codex. Everything got burned by the priests down there, so we don't have their history. But I'm sure in their history would have been them saying the same thing. We were given all this.
And do you believe it ends in the year 2012?
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to wake up that morning with a little bit of a pucker factor going, I'll tell you that. But I really like to hope not. I like to hope not that there's going to be some kind of, it's a symbol of some kind of change. But let's face it, there could be a meteorite coming that we can't see now and don't know and can't do anything about anyway that they knew about. So it's quite possible that's the end of the line.
Well, this has been an incredible dialogue, and I appreciate you coming today. Everybody go to LloydPye.com, LloydPye.com, and tell us about your special one more time.
Well, it's going to be on the National Geographic Monday night, 8 o'clock Eastern Time. It's called Ancient Astronauts, and it will feature actually the Star Child skull, which is something else that I'm involved in that we didn't talk about.
Thanks for joining us. I'll talk to you again. Okay, that was Lloyd Pye, a great guest, and we have a few more minutes before our co-host Candia comes on. So if a lot of this was over your head and a little bit advanced, it's because, if you haven't studied the ancient astronaut theory, this was a very overwhelming conversation. So please go to my website, fountainsofyouth.net. That's plural, fountainsofyouth.net. And I've basically put together an introductory DVD called The Sands of Time. It's $15. And you can order it and get the whole layout, the whole basic premise of this theory. And then you can dive into this whole ancient astronaut theory and have a greater understanding of the pyramids of Egypt and the obelisks and the Costa Rican spheres and the Nazca lines. And it all makes sense, all these different pieces of the puzzle. But you kind of, I've summarized it into this basic DVD, The Sands of Time. So please go to my website and check that out at fountainsofyouth.net. I also have all my lecture dates. I'm lecturing up and down the West Coast, mostly in the Northwest, because that's where I live, in Portland, Oregon. But I'll be in L.A. in early January. So check out my lecture dates. I will fly all around the country and lecture. If you have a group, if you'd like to invite me, I have a great slideshow and a very dynamic presentation. And I'm also a professional tarot card reader, and I can read on the phone. It works on the phone as well as in person. The energy goes right through the telephone line, and so I can definitely give you a dynamic personal reading if you're at a crossroads in your life. So all that information is also on my website at fountainsofyouth.net. So please log on and check that out. Okay, I've been editing my newest DVD, The Temple of Stone, and it's very exciting. I was in the studio yesterday looking at all the images, and we're even going to have some video with this one. And we dig into the temples in Cambodia that I was talking with Lloyd Pye about. They were built later. They were built from 800 A.D. to 1200 A.D., and humans did make them, according to the researchers in the ancient documents. They moved the stones around. However, the actual engineering and the architecture definitely appears to be that of a super race of advanced beings who were in control in the architects and putting all of this together. It's the largest religious structure in the world. If you want to look at a few pictures of it online, just go to Angkor Wat. It's spelled A-N-G-K-O-R-W-A-T, and it's actually on the flag of Cambodia. There's a giant building on the flag, and that is this incredible pyramid structure. And it was built in the middle of the jungle. It wasn't built near a river or near the ocean like most cities, but out in the middle of nowhere. And it was actually lost for several centuries until some French explorers stumbled upon it. They heard rumors and legends about an ancient city that was built by giants or built by the gods, and they decided to explore it, and they found this temple, and it's surrounded by a moat of water. It's It's very beautiful and fascinating, and every inch of these temples is covered with elaborate artwork and stonework, and there's all kinds of pictures of the deities and the gods and the devas all flying around and interacting, and it's incredibly complex stonework. And once again, there are 72 of these buildings within the complex, and I believe that that's a significant number and ties it into the other complexes around the world. And Lloyd Pye was talking about how these edifices and structures on the ground are mirrors of the heavens and the star systems and the constellations. And my research indicates that this is also the case. So the new DVD, The Temple of Stone, will be out within a week or two. You can go on my website, fountainsofuse.net, not .com, it's fountainsofuse.net, and you can see the new DVD. I'm very excited about it, and it will be out soon. So Candia Sanders is our co-host, and she will be joining us for the last 15 minutes. Hopefully it is Thanksgiving, so a lot of people are out and about. And by the way, our time slot is we go live 9 to 10 in the morning, so if you want to call in, go to BBS Radio, get the phone numbers, and call in 9 to 10 live. And then we rerun at night, 9 to 10 Pacific time. And that's taped, of course. And so if you're on the East, it's a bit later. And definitely you can go to bed with us. It's a nice way to end the evening with the Odyssey Radio Show as we talk about ancient mysteries and metaphysical topics. So we're going to move on here. I like to talk about unfiltered news, and one of the great websites I like to go to is Rense. It's RENSE.com. And he has quite a few fascinating stories this week I'd like to dig into. One of them is Dr. Cantwell has written an article about the origins of AIDS. And he basically corresponds to Dr. Streck, who came forward several years ago and said that AIDS was man-made, and that it was not a transmutation from some virus of a monkey in Africa. That's not how it came about, but it was actually created in a laboratory, and it was introduced in America within the gay population. In 1978 through 80, what Dr. Cantwell says is there was a hepatitis B vaccine program in San Francisco and New York among homosexual men. And thousands of men were recruited by our government to participate in these programs. And sure enough, this was the initial group that came up with the AIDS virus in America. And then this same type of testing and experimentation was done among the African population throughout Nigeria and all these different countries. And that's how it spread on the continent of Africa. So it's an interesting theory. Definitely go to Rents and check out this article. It's called Alan Cantwell on the Origins of AIDS. It's RENSE.com. And find out, you know, if this is definitely something we need to look into because they were talking about these hepatitis B vaccine trials that went on for 3 years or so, and then sure enough, the AIDS virus appeared in these communities right around 1981, 82, and then it spread to the general population. So the theory we've been told at the time that it spread from chimps and monkeys in Africa to humans may not be correct, and we just have to investigate it some more as AIDS becomes more and more of a great threat all around the world and is spreading like wildfire in many different countries. Even though we have some vaccines and drugs that keep it under control in the U.S., it's not that way in other countries. It's out of control in many areas. So that was the first article that I saw that was really interesting on Rents. And then, you know, there's always, on our website every day, there's about 20 new articles. He really covers a lot of unfiltered news that's not been talked about in the mainstream. And Jeff Rents was a mainstream reporter and news anchor at one point in his career until he realized all of these cover-ups and decided to join the new media, the new internet online, and create his own radio show and talk show and website. And millions of people go to it each day, actually. So that was one of the first excellent articles I saw this week on Rents. And then There was a great article, you know, last night was the anniversary of JFK being assassinated, and he has this article that the mistress of Lyndon B. Johnson came forward and talked about some of the things Lyndon Johnson said the night before the assassination. And his quote was, "Those SOBs," referring to the Kennedys, "will never embarrass me again." And how would he know that the night before the assassination? But that's what he told his mistress, Madeline Duncan Brown. And there's a long interview with her that you can see at prisonplanet.com or rents.com. Once again, prisonplanet.com goes into all the elaborate details. And that Lyndon Johnson may have had a hand in this situation. He obviously benefited the most. He ascended to the seat of power after that. And Kennedy was trying to do some maverick things. He was trying to pull troops out of Vietnam around 1962 and 63. As a matter of fact, thousands of them were on their way back home on ships during the assassination. And within two or three days, Lyndon Johnson had their ships turned around and sent everyone back. He had orders to bring the troops back into Vietnam within just a couple of days of Kennedy's death. So that was a huge change in the history of America. And the Vietnam War, of course, was just a meat grinder for the next 10, 15 years because of this assassination and change of the hands of power. So that was one big issue. And then another important issue was that Kennedy was trying to issue money backed by silver and gold, backed by our United States Treasury. And he was going against the Federal Reserve, which is actually a private cartel of banks owned by some multi-billionaires and Europeans and the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. And people need to really know that just because it says federal in the title doesn't mean that it's a part of our government necessarily. Is simply an adjective. That's like saying Federal Express is a part of our government. Well, it's not. Federal Express is a private business, a trucking shipping company, and it's merely an adjective. So the Federal Reserve Bank is a private cartel, and they issue money and they loan it to our bank, and they charge interest. So he was trying to get around that. He was trying to print money and coin money, which you're supposed to do according to the Constitution, and bring it out in circulation directly to Americans and loan it without interest. So in that way, he was a real patriot and a real maverick. And by the way, Abraham Lincoln was trying to do the same thing back in the 1800s, change our money system and make it more representative and helpful to the people when he was assassinated. So that was one of Kennedy's projects. And he was able to issue some of that silver money, and you can still find it. It's, of course, worth a lot of money now, but that was his great plan. And, of course, both Kennedy, Bobby, and John were going after the mafia, which was interesting because their father, Joseph, had ties to the mafia and made his money during Prohibition. But for whatever reason, when they got into power, the two young brothers decided to be mavericks and go against the mafia and clean it up and clean up the CIA. And so they created a lot of enemies within the establishment, and we know that Jack Ruby had ties to the mob. So it appears, you know, that a lot of people had a hand in the assassination. It could well have been Johnson and the mafia and the CIA and all of these different entities that were trying to quell these maverick brothers. And, of course, Robert Kennedy was killed a few years later by Saran Saran, but he appears to have been part of a brainwashing program and doesn't even appear to know what he did that day. There's all kinds of interesting interviews with Saran Saran. So once again, this is really unfiltered news, and a lot of it's been coming out more and more and more over the past 40 years about JFK. So that was an interesting article on Rents that I found this week, and definitely go check that out. And one last note, Michael Richards, he was an actor in Seinfeld, went on a big rant and rave at a comedy club this week. He was screaming racial epithets, and a lot of prejudiced comments were made on the stage. But what a lot of people don't know is that he's a high-ranking Freemason and a Shriner and a racist. And there's a lot of indications that the Masons in the South are segregating between the black Masonic groups, the Prince Hall groups, and so he may have been alluding to that, and you can check out that article as well on rents.com. But once again, this Michael Richards is a high-ranking Freemason. So those are three articles that kind of stood out in my mind as I went through that website. And, of course, I mentioned prisonplanet.com as well, a fascinating website where they really get into the New World Order and all of these dynamics. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the Sands of Time DVD in our last few minutes, our last 5 or 10 minutes. We touched on Easter Island today, and as Lloyd Pye, our guest, said, that it definitely could have been made by humans, those statues, though it's unlikely that they would go to all this trouble to make these monuments and then stop making them abruptly. You would think if it's an important part of their culture and their tradition, they would continue making them to this day, and they'd be able to show us how they made them. And once again, 200 of the statues were incomplete. The project was abandoned. And that's never really been adequately explained by the villagers and the tribal people that live there. And, of course, there's only a few thousand of them. So it's always been a fairly small group that's lived on this island. So that's one of the topics I cover in my DVD, The Sands of Time. And you can go on my website, fountainsofuse.net, and order that DVD, The Sands of Time. So my kind of take on Easter Island is that the statues were definitely, they're about 33 feet high on average. They're giant. They weigh, you know, 10, 20, 30 tons, which would be 20,000 to 60,000 pounds. And they were facing outward toward the ocean. And I kind of go along with Eric von Däniken's theory that they were an SOS. They were trying to be rescued. This advanced race of gods were trapped in this island, perhaps. And they were trying to be rescued, and this was an SOS to some kind of neighboring spacecraft to rescue them. And at some point they were rescued, and then they just abruptly left the island and abandoned making all these statues. There was no need for it anymore. So that's the theory that makes sense to me. I'm kind of going along with that one until I hear something better. because we do shift with our research as new things come out. So that's a very fascinating topic. And once again, if you go to LloydPye.com, he has a lot of, he has an interactive website. It has sound and visuals. And you can see this obelisk he was talking about. It was carved out of a gravel pit, but they never finished carving it. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like it was carved by a machine. It was very smooth, clean lines. And almost impossible to carve this hard granite with just chisels and stone primitive tools that they had. So they never finished carving this one out. And you can go to Egypt and visit this and see for yourself. And even if they were to carve it out, it was over 1,200 tons. So they would have had to lift it up somehow. If you can imagine getting a group of people, let's say even if you got 100 strong men around it, to even lift that up would be impossible. It would just be crazy. And then once you've lifted it up, you'd have to move it to its location, you know, several miles to the location of the pyramids or what have you. So it's quite an enigma, quite a mystery. And, you know, I do believe, like Lloyd Pye said, some kind of levitation or advanced system of technology was used to put these obelisks up all around these ancient Egyptian monuments. So that's definitely another big piece of this puzzle. And then he was talking about Peru and the lines of Nazca. And we didn't get to the candelabra, but there's a giant candelabra etched into a mountaintop. And there were actually like stones with ropes tied to it when it was found. And it's this incredible detailed monument of a candelabra. And you can look it up online, actually. And then that leads to the Valley of Nazca with all of these symbols on the ground. And in my DVD, The Sands of Time, I actually go into one of the symbols, which looks like an alien type of creature. It has the large eyes and no hair on its head, kind of a big head, but a short body. And it's etched into the ground in Nazca in Peru. And so they're not all animals. It appears that there's a couple human figures. But there's definitely a monkey, and there's a hummingbird, and there's a whale. And as my guest said, they're not discernible from the ground. They're really of no use or no value to these Indians and these tribes who were living in the ground, you know, a couple thousand years ago. And when you ask them, according to their legends, they say that the gods, the Viracocha gods from South America, came to them and made these symbols that the tribes did not make them, but they refer to the gods, specifically Viracocha, who was kind of their main god, this benevolent teacher, came down and made these symbols upon the driest land on earth. It's a smooth palette. It almost never rains in Nazca. So if you wanted to create symbols that would last for centuries and centuries, that would be the best palette to put them on. And maybe the gods knew this. They had this geographical knowledge of the region, and that's why they put them there. And once again, as Lloyd Pye said, there were all kinds of runways, these giant runways that went for miles and miles and miles, and they had been cleared out. All of the stones had been cleared and leveled. So someone went to a lot of trouble for a culture that did not have trucks and planes and cars, supposedly. So it's all food for thought. Go to my website, see my lectures and DVD, fountainsofyouth.net. Great show. And my co-host, Candia Sanders, will be with you next week. And come join us, and thank you for listening to Odyssey.